that your man didn't voluntarily leave.
I am arguing that.
Well, let me start you off with this, if I can, because I think we have a jurisdictional and lawful and ethical issue I think we need to resolve before we get too far down this road. I gather you've never had any communication with your client at all, correct?
To the extent I can answer that question, I think it presents a whole other ethical issue about attorney-client.
Well, here's my concern, and maybe you can answer it. Both the United States Supreme Court and our Supreme Court have held that the decision to appeal is the client's decision, not counsel's.
Correct.
And that troubles me because in this case, your client essentially received the absolute minimum possible sentence that could go along with a conviction. In other words, a $2,500 suspended fine was the disposition in this case. And if we were to remand this matter for reconsideration or resentencing, whatever you want to call it, obviously there is nowhere for your client to go but down from where he is now, short of an outright dismissal of the charge. And I understand that's what you're asking for, but the reality is that wouldn't be our call. I mean, we might correct the trial court on the law, but we'd have to send it back for disposition. So what troubles me about this is that you're in the position now of asking us to do something which, as far as I can tell, can only hurt your client. And from what I can tell from the record, your client hasn't had any input into this decision. Now, can you satisfy my concerns in that regard?
So I can respond in three ways to that, Your Honor. First, I think without getting into attorney-client confidentiality, the decision to appeal is certainly with the client. However, in the absence, even if there were no communication, I think counsel, and this is something I can tell the court that we did consider, would have to appeal a decision that was legally incorrect. That would be the default. Unless a client waives a right to appeal, that is what is presumed, and that I think is what both our commission and what the rules of ethics would require. So in that respect, we would be required to appeal, even in the absence of having communication with the client. Secondly, obviously, that issue is not before the court. This court obviously has jurisdiction over
signs of error. Well, it is before the court because if your client hasn't consented to this appeal, given our jurisprudence, I question whether we have jurisdiction to consider it. In other words, you know, you can't make this decision unilaterally. And if that's what's happened here, frankly, I'm not sure. And you're an officer of the court, and I'll accept your word on this. I have no reason to doubt it. But I am concerned about that, and we don't take appeals, or we don't really, you know, shouldn't be taking appeals that a client has not been involved in the decision-making process with respect to. So if that's the case, if you tell me that's the case, then we'll proceed. But and we may proceed anyway because my colleagues here may disagree with me, but that's a definite and serious concern that I have, sir.
And I understand that, and obviously I understand the court's position, but I think it would be, for example, if we received a decision from this court and our client is incarcerated or we were not able to get in touch with our client before the notice was due in this court to appeal to the Supreme Court, I think we would have to proceed with the preserving our client's rights on appeal to the Supreme Court, and the same with the notice in the circuit court to this court. We would have to proceed and preserve our client's rights to appeal. We have an obligation to preserve our client's rights to appeal, and that really is paramount, because if we were not to do so and the client did want to appeal, I think we would be in trouble with both this court and the bar.
Well, then that also brings up another issue that's not briefed, but it seems to be it's an obvious situation, and that's the application of the fugitive disentitlement doctrine. He's a fugitive, as I understand it. He didn't appear for disposition of his case. At least he's arguably a fugitive, so tell us why the fugitive disentitlement doctrine wouldn't apply here.
Obviously not brief, but I'm happy to talk a little bit about that. First of all, I would say that obviously the Commonwealth did not raise that either at the petition stage or in the brief stage.
No, but we're not supposed to consider appeals if that doctrine is in play because of the public policy consideration.
Correct, but obviously that presumes...
I'm frankly surprised the Commonwealth didn't raise it. I'm going to deal with them on that, but...
That is not... being a fugitive presumes that someone is voluntarily absent, I would submit. Someone has to be, the failure to appear cases from this court and the Supreme Court, I think would support that.
Well, if we conclude that voluntary departure equals voluntary absence, that would trigger the application of the doctrine, wouldn't it?
think when it was not raised by the Commonwealth, it may not. Again, this was not briefed, so I didn't read all the cases. I'm familiar with the issue, but I didn't honestly read all the issues. I'm happy to brief it if the court thinks that's an issue. But I would submit that his non-voluntary absence, his involuntary absence, makes him not a fugitive.
I mean, if a separate sovereign incarcerates you and gives you a choice between we ship you out following lengthy detention and proceedings, or you can agree to just start your life sooner in your home country by leaving, but either way, essentially, you're leaving, then you're not a fugitive because you're being compelled to leave through a series of options. I mean, that's the argument, isn't it?
Correct.
Well, and that may require some supplemental briefing by you and the Commonwealth, because that seems to me to get to the crux of it. All we have in this record is a letter saying that your client voluntarily departed the United States, whatever that means. Now, there's a lot of assertions outside of the record as to what that means, but the record is pretty sparse. So, you know, does voluntary departure mean what it sounds like, or does it mean, is it bureaucraties for, we put a gun to your head and marched you up onto an airplane and sent you to Bolivia?
And I would submit, and this is what I focus my reply brief on, because obviously it's not an issue that comes up before this court or our circuit courts very often. And the Code of Federal Regulations, I think, makes that clear. Voluntary departure is a method of leaving the country. It's not a choice to not appear in court. The fact is that Mr. Diaz-Nunez was not going to be able to appear before the circuit court one way or the other, and that's because the Code of Federal Regulations states that if someone is granted voluntary departure in either method, as I laid out in my reply brief, a final removal order effective on the date of the voluntary departure is also entered. So even if he had tried to stay in the country as long as he possibly could, he would have, at the end of the day, been removed from the United States forcefully. It's a question of, again, as I laid out in my brief, really who pays for the plane ticket, and that's what
There's no question he was arrested by ICE and that he was deported, right?
Correct. And I believe, and quite frankly, that is on this record what the trial court found. It was in the discussion with the trial court between myself, the Commonwealth, and the trial court, as well as in the trial court's final order in this case. So to the extent that the findings of fact are relevant by the trial court found...
Let me ask you a practical question. I mean, it's too late to null pros once the court enters a finding of... So what's the... And I know you have your backup arguments about dismissing it under stars, you know, et cetera. But leaving that aside for a moment, if the trial court doesn't want to do that, do these cases just get continued into... indefinitely?
I think this court has already answered that question in several cases. In the Head case, for example, this court dealt with what the procedure should be, and the trial court in this case did not follow the procedures that this court set out in Cruz, Head, Sisk, and Hunter. In Head, for example, the trial court went forward with the guilt determination in trial on a robbery, in fact, in the defendant's absence. And this court affirmed that. In terms of sentencing, however, this court found that it was an error for the trial court to continue on in sentencing and should have continued sentencing until such time.
Right, so the answer is on the sentencing point, you just keep continuing it.
Or both. I would submit both in the guilt phase and the sentencing
phase on this record. And maybe that's what the Constitution, we're stuck with, but, I mean, there are large numbers of these illegal immigrants or whatever the fashionable term now is. And, you know, ICE has stepped up deportation on, you know, folks who are convicted of certain crimes. So that leaves the courts with a pretty significant, and the Commonwealth attorneys with a pretty significant administrative burden of tracking these cases into possibly, you know, decades. I mean, if they just restart their life in Bolivia, Mexico, wherever, and maybe that doesn't... That's the way it is. But I mean, you could see that there's a potential significant problem.
And first I would take issue with the fact that just on this record, I believe there's evidence to support that Mr. Diaz-Nunez was legally present in the United States at the time of his sentencing, given the fact that he was issued a restricted license.
Well, I didn't mean to sound pejorative as to your client, but even with those who are legally present, that doesn't answer the question of the administrative burden on the court system and the Commonwealth attorneys.
And certainly in our trial court, people who are not immigrants and were not removed by ICE abscond. Probation violations, bench warrants, capiases, all of those. And the courts throughout this Commonwealth have quite a variety of procedures that they employ in order to keep track of those records. I would submit that it's not increasing that number by any significant amount. It could. I obviously don't have statistics on that, but given the fact that it's not an issue unique to the immigration circumstances, it would not be a unique issue for the trial courts, and they are well equipped, both at the district court and circuit court level, to deal with these type of issues.
Counsel, if we get to the merits of all this, I understand that the relief you're seeking is that we order the circuit court here to dismiss the charge.
No, Your Honor.
No?
I'm asking for reverse and remand. I think that would be the most...
For what purpose?
For the trial court to follow the procedures this court has laid out in its jurisprudence on this issue, and then I would, in my argument for the trial court,
would be what Judge Collins suggests. Your argument stars, but this is a case that actually falls within the statute.
Correct.
So, now, I guess one way to interpret stars, and it's in the other cases that led up to it, is that nothing the General Assembly does in this area has any meaning. All those statutes are unconstitutional. But if that's the case, what authority is there to defer a finding and put someone on terms and conditions of probation, which is what was done here? All Starr says is the court has inherent authority to essentially not make a decision. But by not making a decision, that doesn't give the court the authority to impose what amounts to probation on someone with terms and conditions any more than an innocent person can be subject to that, because they haven't been in your innocent until proven guilty, and there hasn't been an adjudication of guilt. The statute provides, a mechanism for that, but if the statute's a nullity, where does that leave us?
Well, I don't think the statute's a nullity, and I'm also, obviously, this court cannot order a trial court to dismiss a case based off of stars. That's, I think, a trial court determination. My issue with the trial court in this case and my assignment of error is simply that the trial court stated it did not have the authority to do so under the Virginia Constitution as outlined by Starrs.
But wasn't that sort of in the context of an academic discussion of Starrs and the back and forth between what the trial court characterizes this court and the back and forth between this court and the Supreme Court? The court acknowledged this was a statutory case.
Correct. I guess to the extent that Harris brings up the statutory case, and to the extent Harris and Starrs are in conflict, I think this court... opinion in Harris does in many ways conflict with Starrs, and to the extent that it does, it would be not correct.
I simply think Judge McCullough's point is simply that the remarks made by the court can't be taken as, or shouldn't be taken as, a judicial determination of lack of authority, because the statute provides a clear grant of authority in this case that the court followed. So
I think the reason I bring it up, Your Honor, is in the final order in this case, the trial court did specifically delineate that it stated that counsel moved to dismiss it pursuant to 251, which after hearing argument, the court denied. And then counsel further moved for the court to enter a disposition pursuant to Starrs versus Commonwealth in a separate line, and that the court denied that. So there were two, the trial court at the very least believed there were two separate requests. I would submit they are related. As I mentioned in my brief, 251 is really just a legislative expression of the inherent authority of the trial court as outlined in Starrs.
Kennedy, I appreciate the position you're in. It's my understanding that basically what you said was, if I don't have any communication with my client to appeal or not to appeal, the default position is appeal.
Correct.
Okay. I guess on the theory being that if I don't, I'm subject to habeas, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes.
But as Judge Humphrey points out, if this gets remanded and they get your guy back here, and such judge gives him 2 years in the penitentiary...
Now you're looking at a habeas.
Now you're looking at real habeas.
I'm obviously I'm in a difficult position. I am doing what I believe is ethically required under the Virginia State Bar.
There's no question but that you are. But, it could have serious consequences, not just for your client, but for you.
I would certainly hope that the trial court would take into account everything that had happened. And obviously, I'm doing what I can and what I believe is ethically required in this case. Obviously,
and I admire you for it.
If I may reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
Certainly, ma'am.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Chris Shanville for the Commonwealth. I'll begin with Judge Humphrey's question, because I assume he would like me to. I'm not sure which I ought to begin with. First, on the issue of kind of the ethical considerations as to filing an appeal without perhaps consent from the client. That's an issue that I'd be happy to brief if the court would like to order additional briefing on that topic. Of course, Commonwealth has no insights into whether or not that communication has occurred. And I don't believe that counsel has stated here this afternoon whether or not that conversation did occur. It's my impression that the position of opposing counsel is that without some sort of explicit waiver, he's ethically required to file an appeal in a case like this where his position is that the conviction and sentence were incorrect as a matter of law. So if the court would like additional briefing on that topic, I'd be happy to provide additional briefing.
There's scores of habeas cases out there that address counsel's obligation to appeal in the absence of express or ambiguous instructions from the client.
The case law is not...
That doesn't address directly necessarily Virginia ethical responsibilities. It's in the context of constitutional Strickland ineffective assistance of counsel. But there are cases out there that address that from that angle.
Well, in my understanding of the case law under Miles versus Sheriff, which is the Supreme Court of Virginia case, there is an obligation constitutionally to file a petition for appeal if the client makes an express and timely request that
right.
appeal be filed.
One of the considerations for an appeal, of course, is what are the possible outcomes? And as I indicated, my chief concern here is that the client basically has nowhere to go but down from where he is right now, assuming the disposition of this case were to be anything other than an outright dismissal.
Correct. And in the habeas context, in deciding whether or not there was an express and timely request to file an appeal and whether or not the client was prejudiced by a failure to have a conversation about whether the client might have wanted to have an appeal, one of the things that's taken into consideration is what would be the possible outcome of winning an appeal and then coming back to trial.
Counsel's indicated that he's ethically feels very strongly that he's doing the appropriate thing. And it's really not for us to second guess that at this point. Again, from a jurisdictional standpoint, the reason I asked the question was, there's some issue about whether, in the absence of permission, we should be deciding an appeal. But, the counsel hasn't directly answered that question. And I'm prepared to assume that he's thought his position through and, he's apparently willing to accept whatever the consequences are. So, what about the fugitive disentitlement doctrine? Do you have any position on that?
Without getting too far into kind of attorney work product and the inner workings of the office, I will say that the argument was considered and it was determined that it, while perhaps a viable argument, was not the strongest argument we had. And so we focused the brief.
We're supposed to decide these cases on the merits of grounds, and if we don't have to reach the merits because of, what struck me immediately is if the doctrine applies here, that would be the narrowest and best grounds to resolve, it seems to me.
But if
you're conceding that it doesn't apply, then...
I'm not conceding that it doesn't apply. I'm conceding that we determined it wasn't the strongest argument, but I will certainly defer to the court's determination if it is a stronger argument.
Doesn't it kind of essentially merge into this whole voluntariness notion anyway? In other words, if he freely, of his own accord, left the country, then it doesn't really make any difference whether we label that the fugitive disentitlement doctrine or we just say, well, there was a voluntary departure, and so therefore we can go ahead and sentence him.
Right.
Right?
Right. The underlying issues, the underlying facts that we go to making that determination are similar. I think the policy considerations behind the separate doctrines is what led the Commonwealth to focus on the voluntary waiver of a right to be present at trial and at sentencing, and then, of course, to argue as
I think
we have.
We all look at these things. If there's a way to get around deciding the STARS issue, that's the way we're trying to go.
Well, and I would submit that the fact that this was decided based under 18.2.251 gets us around the STARS issue, is that we have a statute that's directly on point, which we did not have in those cases. And so the court under 251 had the discretion, the statute explicitly says, may enter an adjudication of guilt if there's a finding that the terms and conditions of probation were not met. So he had that discretion, and he found that STARS doesn't give me any additional discretion that I don't already have under the statute, and so he made his ruling under the statute.
Right.
So you could argue either.
So STARS is just an academic point, the way I see it, in the context of this appeal.
Yes, Your Honor, in the context of a case where a statute controls determination.
Let me ask you this, just sort of getting to what I think is the heart of the issue. There's no question he was arrested and subject to deportation proceedings. And so you, in your brief, pointed out, but he availed himself of this option of voluntary departure. And the reply brief says, well, but how voluntary is voluntary when a sovereign picks you up, arrests you, and then, you know, manu militari, so to speak, you know, carts you out of the country? Although you say, well, fine, I'll just pay for the ticket myself instead of being subject to this lengthy proceeding.
Right.
How voluntary is that under the context of this federal scheme?
And I would submit that it's important first to understand that the issue that we're considering is not whether or not he was ultimately at some point going to be deported, whether he liked it or not. The issue is whether or not he voluntarily was not present at that hearing, which was scheduled for a year after that November, I think, 13th or 19th, 2013, whether or not he voluntarily absented himself 1 year later. So I would submit that by taking advantage of this kind of shortcut to voluntarily depart earlier than he otherwise perhaps would have had to, and through making no effort whatsoever to notify the court that, you know, that he might not be able to be present for a hearing a year later as it, when it was scheduled, he made no effort through his attorney to contact the court. According to the record, there's no indication he made any effort to complete any terms of his probation, that is sufficient for a finding that he voluntarily failed to make any effort to be able to appear for this court date, where he was scheduled to appear for an ultimate adjudication of guilt and possibly sentencing. And I've submitted a couple of cases, and there are very few cases out there on this particular issue. State ex rel Thomas versus Blakely, which is an Arizona Court of Appeals case, actually deals with this exact issue, whether or not you can find someone has waived their right to be present for trial by voluntarily departing through this very procedure that the defendant in this case took advantage of. In that case, the trial court held as a matter of law that he did not voluntarily waive his right to be present because he voluntarily departed. The Arizona Court of Appeals actually reversed the trial court, so it was the opposite procedural posture, and the Court of Appeals held as a matter of law that he did voluntarily waive his right to be present by taking advantage of this procedure, and the court talked about the other avenues that are available to a defendant who is in this position, how he can,
I mean, one of the problems we have on this record is, how do I know if he hadn't done that? In other words, if he said, I'm going to fight this tooth and nail, would he have had the opportunity to appear?
Well, what we know is that he didn't make any effort to prolong the process long enough so that he would have an opportunity to appear.
Was he in custody?
He was taken into custody 3 months after the initial 251 hearing where the court said, I'm going to find that the facts are sufficient and deferred his position.
During those 3 months, the record reflects he did nothing to satisfy any of the terms and conditions.
Correct, Your Honor. That was in the letter from the probation officer that there's no indication that he had any opportunity to do anything.
Was he in ICE custody?
He was taken into ICE custody 3 months after that initial hearing where the court found the facts sufficient and deferred his position.
Okay.
And there's no indication he made any attempt to comply with the terms of his probation during those 3 months. Because he took advantage, as I argued, of this voluntary departure process, that demonstrates that he made no effort either to appeal what might have been a final determination, a determination that he was removable. He made no effort to apply for status as under political asylum, which he also, the state ex rel versus Thomas versus Blakely, discusses that's an option available to these defendants.
If the facts warrant, we just don't know.
Correct. I would at least concede that he very well may have had a difficult choice facing him as to whether to voluntarily depart and hope that gives him a better chance of returning at a later date, or to actually fight the process and stay in the States as long as he could in order to make it to this one-year hearing where he could try to do his probation in the meantime. It may have been a difficult choice to decide between the two, but he was granted essentially an act of mercy under 251 to say, if you're able to do meet these requirements, we may consider a different disposition. And he made his choice that it would be better for him to voluntarily depart and take whatever the consequences are as a result of not being present 1 year later.
Well, Judge McCullough raised some of the practical issues with your opponent. I'd like you to comment on them. It seems to me that if we were to grant the relief sought here and remand this matter, one of two things would have to happen. The court would dispose of the matter because the defendant still hasn't appeared, and we'd be right back where we started, or it would have to continue the matter indefinitely despite the fact that the deferral period has already elapsed. And then how would we ever get it, you know, how would we ever basically close the case without knowing? Is there any other considerations you think we ought to consider for the Commonwealth's viewpoint?
I would submit that Cruz versus Commonwealth is the best case on this particular issue, and that case talks about prejudice to the Commonwealth in a case where a defendant fails to appear for trial. And specifically, I mean, in this case, we didn't have witnesses who weren't available or anything of that sort. But what we do have, and what Cruz talks about, is the fact that in cases where there's no indication in the record, or even a hint in the record, that the defendant will at some later time be available for trial or for sentencing, the Commonwealth is necessarily prejudiced by continuing the case out further and further and further with no indication of any resolution.
You have one of these guilty plea / deferred disposition type things. If there's no developed trial record, you know, you don't even have a transcript or whatever, or exhibits to go back on, and then the witnesses are going to scatter, retire, move, whatever, and so then essentially you get to skate by being deported.
Right, and I would submit, I think it's Cruz that talks about the fact that a defendant is not allowed to take advantage of his own wrong, and certainly I would submit that to an extent that is what would be occurring in this case if he's allowed to, as Your Honor suggested, skate just because he took advantage of this voluntary departure.
Now, would your answer
procedure
be different if he hadn't taken advantage of this voluntary?
And if instead he had been initially,
in other words,
forcibly
if he
removed?
He had on bended knee, told the United States government, I need to be in Fairfax Circuit Court to resolve this matter. The government said, well, that's Virginia's problem, not ours. And then they go through the proceedings. You committed this crime, you're deported, and off you go.
Mm-hmm. I think my answer as to whether or not he voluntarily waived his right to be present in a case like that likely would be different, or at least I would have to admit that I'd have a much higher uphill battle if there were any indication of any efforts made to make it to that hearing. And in this case, there was no indication that he made any effort to be available. I would also submit that not only is it a problem as to the conviction, but also as to sentencing. I'm just kind of continuing the case out over and over and over again for an opportunity to sentence the defendant doesn't place the Commonwealth or the court system in any better of a situation, any better of a place. And I would submit that Head versus Commonwealth addresses this question of whether or not a defendant can be sentenced in his absence. In that particular case, the court looked at the statute for misdemeanor convictions and said you can't sentence an individual on a misdemeanor conviction where he gets jail time in his absence. And then in Head, the court considered whether that same principle should apply in the felony context. In Head, the defendant got a 5-year jail prison sentence, and the court said there it was wrong to sentence him in his absence because one of the fundamental kind of underlying principles here is that in a circumstance where an individual may lose his liberty or his life, he should have a right to be present. I would submit to the court that holding does not go so far as to apply in this context, because in this context, Mr. Nunez got a completely suspended fine. So it's not a situation where he went to jail, he went to prison. So those policy considerations, which did merit extending kind of the principles.
Well, he's got court costs.
He additionally also has court costs, correct,
and
Your Honor.
And he's probably got public defender's costs. Well, you know, one way to solve the administrative problem that Judge McCullough raises is if you remand it to Commonwealth hearing and just go say, Judge, this guy's in Columbia and he's never coming back and you didn't get him any jail time, we move to null prosit.
And that may be a possibility, but I would submit that the Commonwealth should not be required to do that.
They wouldn't be required to do it.
Can you at this stage null pros? I mean, there's been a finding.
Now we can't. It's been a final disposition, but I would assume that any time before there's a final disposition, the Commonwealth would have.
Any time we remanded, it's
okay.
Open again.
I'd finally just like to submit, because I did raise a point in my brief, but maybe perhaps did not develop it fully, is the fact that even if the court were to find that he did not voluntarily waives the right to be present at trial or at sentencing, that that is still subject to harmless error analysis and a constitutional harmless error analysis. I would submit that in this particular context, as the court has said, he got really the least he could have gotten. Because he pled guilty, he admitted that he was pleading guilty because he was indeed guilty.
Are there any cases that say we can do harmless error to that? I mean, because there's structural error, which
right.
is not subject to harmless error. And then there's, you know, most things, which is subject to that.
So I've cited two cases to the court on brief. One of them is United States versus Allen, which is a Fifth Circuit case. The other one is Russian versus Spain, which is the Supreme Court of the United States case. In Russian, since that's a Supreme Court case, there is a footnote, looks like footnote number 2, in which the court says, this case came to us alleging harmless violations of the right to be present during all critical stages of the proceedings and the right to be represented by counsel. And we therefore analyze only that challenge. These rights, as with most constitutional rights, are subject to harmless error analysis. So I would submit that that case stands for the fact that you can't do harmless error analysis here.
It kind of feels like a structural error, you know, when you think about like counsel being present, the defendant being present. But if the court has said that.
The court has said that. I'll defer to their reasoning and analysis. And I would submit that this would be, if there's ever an appropriate case for harmless error analysis and application, that this would be it. He already pleaded guilty. The court found there was overwhelming evidence of his guilt. And then nothing he could have said at if he had been present at this hearing could have undone the evidence against him or really counseled in favor of a lighter sentence than he got because it was a fully suspended fine. So even notwithstanding the arguments I've made, that at the end of the day, even if the court were to find he did not voluntarily waive when he voluntarily departed, any error would still be harmless. We would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you,
Your Honors.
We asked you a lot of questions, and you didn't get to develop the merits as much. So go ahead and respond to the arguments.
Thank you. I'd like to focus on a few issues, Your Honor, if I could. First is the issue about notice that the defendant could be tried in his absence. There is the bond form in this case. When the court looks at the orders in this case in between the plea and then the first sentencing event in 2013.
He's actually already been tried. The only thing that hasn't been done is the verdict.
Correct. There's already, facts sufficient were found
right.
and admitted to, obviously. And obviously a guilty plea, according to Starrs and many other cases of this court and the Supreme Court, is a self-supplied conviction, which goes to why there actually is not prejudice to the Commonwealth in this case. However, as to the notice and being tried and sentenced in his absence, the defendant at the final, when the 251 disposition was imposed, there was no warning at that time that he could be tried in his absence. There is the bond form. However, unlike in between the plea and the 2013 sentencing event, between the 2013 sentencing and the return date, there is no indication that the defendant remained on bond. And in Head, this court stated that when a guilty plea, for example, is entered into, the warnings and the colloquy that the court goes through listing all of the consequences of a guilty plea, the fact that a defendant is not warned at that time that he may be tried or sentenced in his absence if he fails to appear at a future proceeding could lead the defendant to believe that, in fact, he is not subject to that trial and absence, and therefore he is not on warning and doesn't have proper notice under the Constitution for him to be tried or sentenced in his absence upon his return. And obviously, given that this is a constitutional right and there was a presumption against waiver, that would even go more strongly in favor of the fact that not only in terms of the fact that he was not voluntarily absent, but the fact that he was not on notice that he could be tried in his absence would lead to this court on both the first and the second assignment of error needing to reverse and remand.
What about harmless error?
In terms of harmless error, the Commonwealth correctly cites the cases it cited for that proposition. I don't concede that this is not structural error. It certainly looks, I agree with you, Judge McCullough, that it looks a lot like structural error. However, given the Commonwealth's cases, it would certainly have to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, given the fact that there was obviously...
At least looking at from the lens of the outcome.
Although dismissal is an option. Even under Harris, under the statute, under Starrs, dismissal is an outcome.
If the statute and Starrs... it's a discretionary call.
It is.
And so to say you can dismiss when you haven't done a thing to comply with, perhaps through no fault of his own. He was in custody. But nevertheless, you know, there's this finding that, you know, the facts are sufficient, you've done absolutely nothing, or perhaps because you couldn't do anything to comply, and then to get a dismissal at the back end seems like an unlikely scenario for dismissal, even though that's an abstract possibility.
Although if he were returned under, I would submit, stars in the court's inherent authority, the court could certainly have given him additional time, and I would submit that in trial courts across this Commonwealth...
In other words, time to comply.
Further time to comply.
Right, right.
Not that the trial court would be required in that moment when he returned to dismiss the case, but the trial court could have taken other options, and certainly that happens in circuit courts across this Commonwealth. Your Honor, I think that, unless the court has any other questions, I think I've, between my arguments and my briefs, fairly covered the issue.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll come down to Greek Council and...